In black and white, searchlights ply over a stone monument chiseled with the words 20th Century Fox. Waves lap against a rocky shoreline. Jean Tierney, Rex Harrison, and George Sander star in The Ghost and Mrs. Muir, with Edna Best, Vanessa Brown, Anna Lee, Robert Coote, Natalie Wood, Isabel Elsom and Victoria Horn. Screenplay by Philip Dunn from the novel by R.A. Dick. Music by Bernard Herrmann. Produced by Fred Colmar, directed by Joseph L. Mankiewicz. The scene fades, replaced by a view of London at the turn of the century. Mist hangs over the River Thames. The clock tower of Big Ben rises up in the distance. A covered, horse-drawn cart rattles round a street corner. A man wearing a caped overcoat and carrying a briefcase exchanges words with a policeman standing on the pavement. The policeman tips his cap and the man crosses the road. He approaches a house with weeds climbing through the fence. Curtains are drawn across the windows. Inside, three women sit around the tea table. One is elderly, one middle-aged. The third, Lucy, is young and beautiful.
And now my mind is made up.
Oh, Lucy.
I never heard of such a thing.
Oh, Lucy, Lucy.
Please don't make it more difficult. I know you've tried to be generous and kind, but it simply won't work, my living here.
Eva, speak to her.
Are you serious, Lucy?
Yes, Eva, I am.
And poor Edwin, barely cold in his grave.
He's been dead almost a year now.
Still, you might have some consideration for your husband's memory.
I don't see what Edwin's got to do with this. I'm not leaving him. I'm leaving you.
Oh, after all we've tried to do for him.
You mustn't think I'm not grateful. You've both been so very kind to me. But I'm not really a member of the family, except for marrying your son and... And now he's gone, I have my own life to live, and you have yours. And they simply won't mix. I've never had a life of my own. It's been Edwin's life, and yours and Eva's. Never my own.
Stop sniveling, Mother. If she's determined to make a fool of herself, there's nothing we can do about it.
But what will I have to remind me of poor Edwin?
Lucy, have you considered Anna?
Yes, Eva, I have.
And you're willing to take the responsibility for what might become of her?
She's my daughter, Eva.
And what do you mean by that?
Only what I said.
You're insinuating that I interfere with Anna. Don't deny it, Lucy.
Anna's listening at the door.
Don't deny it, I say.
I'm not denying it, Eva.
Eva paces to the window.
Please, can't we discuss this without quarreling?
I'm sure I don't know how you'll manage, Lucy. You haven't any money. I have the income from Edwin's gold shares, and Anna and I can live quite cheaply with Martha.
Do you mean you're taking Martha Huggins?
And why not? She was with me before I came to live with you.
Of all the ungrateful...
Please, Eva. I'm sorry, but I've made up my mind.
But where, Lucy? Where can you go?
The seaside, I think. I've always wanted to live by the sea.
Oh, goody.
Anna and Martha are both listening.
Well, that's all I have to say.
I should think it's quite enough. Apparently, there's nothing we can do about it. But when you realize your mistake and try to come crawling back to us, don't expect any encouragement from me.
I won't, Eva.
Lucy lifts her chin and with dignity heads to the kitchen. Eva stands by her mother's chair. In the kitchen, Anna and Martha back away from the door. Lucy smiles as she comes in.
Well, it's a blooming revolution, that's what.
Two porters lift a heavy trunk marked Mrs. Lucy Muir, Whitecliffe by the Sea, care of station agent. It's away, leaving Lucy, her daughter Anna, and Martha the cook standing on the platform.
Isn't Whitecliffe beautiful, Martha?
Lucy walks up to her house agents, Itchen, Bowles and Coombe. It's a quaint building with diamond-leaded glass in the door. Lucy wears a black cloak and a black hat with a veil. She spots something in the window and lets herself in. The man behind the desk is eating.
Oh, I am sorry.
It's quite all right.
Are you Mr. Itchen?
Mr. Itchen passed on 30 years ago. May he rest in peace.
Mr. Bowles.
Likewise. Oh,
then you're Mr. Coon.
Junior.
Of course, you answered my letter. Please eat it.
Thank you.
I'm Mrs. Muir.
Mrs. Muir, of course. You were desirous of renting a house.
Yes.
Yes. Well, I've selected several prospects suitable to a young lady in bereaved circumstances.
He takes a file from the drawer.
Bowles Sojour. Seaside villa, 3 beds, 2 recept, complete offices, companies, gas and water, ideally sits near bus stops, modern drains, private garden, £120, £10 deposit.
I'm afraid that's a little too expensive.
Another glances at Lucy and moves on to a third.
Laburnum Mount, first class residential street, 4 bed, 1 recept, sun parlour, offices, companies, gas and water, beautifully planted, short walk
this
from...
Gull Cottage.
What was that, madam?
This house, Gull Cottage. It's exactly the sort of place I'm looking for.
Gull Cottage? Oh, no. That wouldn't suit you at all. Laburnum Mount. First class residential street. 4 bed, 1 recept, sun parlour, offices, companies, gas and water.
And only £52. That's very little for a furnished house.
It's a ridiculous price.
I suppose there's something wrong. Is it the drains?
When Itchen, Bowles and Coombe put up a house for rent, you may be sure there is nothing wrong with the drains.
Then why shouldn't it suit me?
My dear young lady, you must allow me to be the judge of that. Now, where were we? Oh, yes. Laburnum Mount. Beautifully planted, short walk from...
But if I'm going to live in the house, I should be the judge.
You'll only waste your time.
But it's my time. I believe there's another house agency in Whitecliff. Perhaps they have Gull Cottage listed, too.
She stands to go.
Very well, madam, if you insist.
Mr. Coombe, Jr. blows out the little meth's burner that warms his teapot.
I shall drive you to Gull Cottage in my motor car.
Very good of you, Mr. Coombe.
Sheep graze on a hillside overlooking the sea. Mr. Coombe's motor car putters along the narrow clifftop road towards a large, isolated house. The house looks out over the curve of the bay to a rocky promontory beyond. The car draws up. Lucy gets out and walks up to the gate. She smiles at the aspect in front of her. She tries to open the gate, which has fallen off its hinges. Lifting it aside, she walks up the overgrown path towards the front steps. Mr. Coombe follows.
Mrs. Muir, it's only a short drive to Laburnum Mount.
But I want to see the inside.
The inside?
Of course. What on earth's the matter?
Very well, if you insist.
She reaches the front door, beneath an elegant wrought iron porch. Mr. Coombe fumbles with the key. Inside is a large, light hallway. Lucy steps in, looking round admiringly. Mr. Coombe shuts the door behind them. Lucy walks to the stairs and looks up. She blows dust off the banisters.
Terrible dust.
The house has been empty for nearly 4 years.
Oh.
Office is back there. Living on the right, dining off the living.
The doors of the living room stand ajar. Lucy pushes one open. A man's face looms out of the darkness. Lucy peers closer. It's a portrait of a sea captain.
Oh, of course. It's a painting.
She steps into the room.
I thought for a moment. Who is it?
The former owner, a Captain Gregg.
A sea captain. That explains the scheme of decoration, doesn't it?
Which is in frightful taste.
Oh, I don't agree with you. It's really a lovely room. And most of the furniture will do as it is.
Mrs. Muir, I must beg of you not to be so precipitous. I assure you this house will not suit you at all.
Oh, but it does. It suits me perfectly. What a hideous tree.
Quite.
What kind of a tree is it?
I believe it is called a monkey puzzle tree.
Why?
Because it defies the efforts of monkeys to climb it, presumably.
It ruins the view. I'll have it chopped down.
Lucy suddenly stiffens.
Did you say something, Mr. Coombe?
No, I did not.
She regains her composure.
Well, I think I'd better see the rest of it.
As you wish, Mrs. Muir.
He ushers her to the door. Lucy pauses to glance back over her shoulder, then heads out. They enter the kitchen with its old-fashioned range. Pewter tankards hang from the mantelpiece. Lucy goes to examine it. She walks to the sink and turns on a tap. Water gushes out. Satisfied, she smiles at Mr. Coombe's, then stares.
What on earth?
What, Mrs. Muir?
That table. I thought you said no one had been here.
I said nothing of the sort. I said the house had been emptied. It has. A charwoman was here last week.
She must have left in a frightful hurry.
That she did.
Did she tell you why?
She told me nothing. She returned the key to the office whilst I was out.
An abandoned meal is on the table.
Oh. Mrs. Muir, I
know. It won't suit me, but it does.
She heads for the door, then turns to him and smiles.
I'd like to see the upstairs.
She sweeps out.
The upstairs.
Mr. Coombe follows. Lucy waits at the bottom of the staircase, which climbs to a half landing, then divides. Lucy indicates Mr. Coombe should lead the way. Reluctantly, he does so, taking the right-hand sweep. He reaches the top landing. A model sailing ship is perched on the rail.
The main bedroom.
He opens the door for her. Lucy walks in. Light streams in through a large bay window. A telescope on an ornate stand is set, looking out to sea. Mr. Coombe looks around warily. Lucy steps up to the telescope.
Of course. You like to watch the ships.
Mm.
But what? That's what it is. You're clean.
I beg your pardon, Mrs. Muir.
Oh, not you, Mr. Coombe. The telescope. Did you laugh, Mr. Coombe?
Coombe has fled. Lucy runs after him. She dashes down the stairs and through the front door. Coombe locks it behind her. Lucy stops on the path and turns, panting. She swallows.
You would come. I didn't want to show it to you, but oh, no, no, you had to see it.
Haunted. How perfectly fascinating.
Fascinating? I suppose it's fascinating that this house is driving me to drink. To drink. 4 times I rented it, and 4 times the tenants have left after the very first night. The owner's in Australia, Captain Gregg's cousin. I've written to him, cabled him, begging him to release me, but he only replies, rely on you. Well, I don't want to be relied on. I never want to see this house again. I wish Captain Gregg had lived to be 100. I wish he'd never been born.
I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Coombe.
Well, at least you know now why it won't suit you.
Yes, I suppose so. Why does he haunt? Was he murdered?
No. He committed suicide.
I wonder why.
To save someone the trouble of assassinating him, no doubt. Come, we'll go to Laverne and Mark.
Lucy gazes curiously at the house. A shutter closes in the bedroom window.
Mrs. Muir, if you please.
You'll probably think it very silly of me, Mr. Coombe. But I have decided to take Gull Cottage after all. I mean, if everyone rushes off at the slightest sound, of course the house gets a bad name. But it's too ridiculous, really, in the 20th century to believe in apparitions and all that medieval nonsense.
But you heard him laugh.
I heard what might have been a laugh, or what might have been the wind roaring down the chimney.
If I may say so, Mrs. Muir, tiddlesticks.
I want Gull Cottage.
In my opinion, you are the most obstinate young woman I have ever met.
Thank you, Mr. Coombe. I've always wanted to be considered obstinate.
Very well, Mrs. Muir.
She climbs into the car.
On the understanding that I disclaim all responsibility for what may happen, you shall have Gull Cottage.
He puts a rug over her lap. Lucy is ironing. Martha is scrubbing the kitchen floor.
Don't you dare.
A little Highland Terrier scampers down the steps from the back door.
Bringing your muddy feet through my nice clean kitchen? Landlubber. There. Nothing like soap and water to make everything ship-shape and Bristol fashion.
Yes. What did you say, Martha?
Why, I said...
What did I say?
Ship-shape and Bristol fashion. I've never heard you use that expression before.
Huh. Must have been the sea air.
Come on, Mrs. Muir. I'll have that iron, if you please.
But I'm nearly finished.
You've done enough hard work for today. And besides... You know, you're supposed not to be...
If you're going to start telling me I'm not strong, I'll pack you off back to London on the first train.
Dear old London, how I miss it. Now, come along. Upstairs to your room. And a bit of shut-eye before tea.
Martha bustles Lucy into the hall.
I feel so useless. Here I am, nearly halfway through life. What have I done?
I know what I've done, all right. Cooked enough steaks to choke an hippopotamus. And kept the name of Uggins as fair as the day I found it.
You've led a very useful life, Martha.
I have nothing to show for all my years.
I suppose you call Miss Anna nothing.
Oh, heavens, I can't take any credit for her. She just happened.
Yes, that's what my old mum always used to say.
I was the... In the bedroom, Lucy shuts the French windows.
Oh,
hurt yourself? Yeah, let's have a look.
Oh, it's nothing. Just a scrape. But I am tired. I think I will...
She settles in a chair by the fireplace.
Begging your pardon, Your Honor.
Martha lifts the terrier off a rug on the sofa and puts the rug over her mistress.
There. This'll keep you nice and warm.
She tucks it in. Lucy smiles up at her.
Thanks, Martha. You're an angel.
Ain't noticed any wings sprouting lately.
Martha collects her washing basket and heads for the door.
I'll call you in plenty of time for tea.
Lucy snuggles under the rug and shuts her eyes. The French window slowly opens. Wind rustles the curtains. A ship's clock above the mantelpiece shows the time as 4 o'clock. The dog on the sofa looks up. A dark figure appears and stands looking down at the sleeping Lucy. He steps closer to her and makes to sit down. Time moves on from 4 o'clock to 5. The room's grown darker. Lucy's still sleeping. She stirs, troubled. She opens her eyes. Frowning, she sits up and looks at the open window, swinging in the breeze. She pulls the rug off her lap and gets up. She peers curiously at the window, examining the catch. She shuts it firmly, then touches the wound on her hand, remembering. She glances over to the door. It swings ajar. Lucy tenses. Martha pops her head round and peers cautiously in. Lucy smiles and relaxes.
It's you.
I crept up, not wanting to wake you in case you were still asleep. Tea's all ready.
Miss Anna will have it all cleared off in no time, if you don't hurry.
To the dog.
I got a nice bit of fresh fish for you too.
Martha, I had such a curious dream.
Did I close the window before I went to sleep?
You did. And scraped your finger, don't you remember? It's shut now, ain't it?
Lucy stands, frowning, and stares at the window.
It's shut now.
She follows Martha out of the room. Pausing in the doorway, she looks back once more, then shuts the door behind her. Lightning flashes in the empty room. Later, Lucy's putting Anna to bed.
Keep going. Good night, Mummy. I love the sea, and so does Rummy.
And so do I.
Lucy turns out the light. The terrier, Ronnie, is on Anna's bed. Anna snuggles under the covers. With a fond glance at her daughter, Lucy goes out onto the landing. She turns down the gas light on the wall by Anna's door. Martha comes upstairs.
I've brought water bottles on the kitchen table, Mum, and the kettle's on the stove.
Oh, thank you, Martha.
Good night. Good night.
She hands Lucy a candle.
Shall I leave this on?
Oh, no. This'll do nicely.
Martha turns out the other gas light and goes into her room. By the light of the candle, Lucy heads downstairs. A tree outside the window is lashed by the wind. Lightning flickers across Lucy's face. At the bottom of the stairs, she hesitates. Tilting her head as if she hears something, she steps across the hall to the living room. Face in the portrait looms white in the darkness. Lucy shuts the door and smiles to herself. She walks into the lighted kitchen and blows out her candle. She sets the candlestick down on the table and walks over to the range. She takes a match, strikes it, and tries to light the gas ring. The match goes out. She takes another. Both it and the lamp are blown out. Lucy glances up in alarm. Taking a third match, she tries to light the lamp. The kitchen window bursts open. A torrent of rain blows in. Lucy forces the window shut. She draws herself up and tries to compose herself, smoothing down her dress. She walks back to the table, takes a box of matches and tries to light her candle. With trembling fingers, she lifts the candle to the flickering flame. The match blows out. Lucy puts the candle down and addresses the darkness.
I know you're here.
She turns nervously around. The shadowy room is empty.
I say, I know you're here. What's wrong? Are you afraid to speak up? Is that all you're good for, to frighten women? Well, I'm not afraid of you. Who ever heard of a cowardly ghost? Now, if the demonstration is over, I'll thank you not to interfere while I boil some water for my hot water bottle.
Light the...
She jumps.
Go ahead. Light it.
How can I when you keep blowing out the match?
Light the blasted candle.
She fumbles with the matchbox and strikes a match. She lights the wick, then moves the candle to illuminate parts of the room. The sea captain steps out of the corner a few feet from her.
Well?
You'll forgive me if I take a moment to get accustomed.
He's a tall, imposing figure with a trim beard and moustache. Lucy swallows.
You're Captain Gregg.
Aye.
I'm sorry I called you names. Coward and so forth. I didn't really believe in you, or I wouldn't have. Must have been embarrassing to you.
Why?
Why, I mean, because of the way you died.
Glaring, he steps closer.
The way I died, madam.
I mean because you committed suicide.
What made you think I committed suicide?
Mr. Coombs?
Ah, Coombs a fool. They're all fools. I went to sleep in front of that confounded gas heater in my bedroom and I must have kicked the gas on with my foot in my sleep. It was a stormy night, like this. Half a gale blowing from the south-southwest into my window, so I shut them as any sensible man would. Wouldn't you?
Yes, I suppose so.
Then the coroner's jury brought it in as suicide because my blasted charwoman testified I always slept with my windows open. How the devil should she know how I slept?
Oh, I'm so glad.
You have a strange sense of humor, madam.
I mean because you didn't commit suicide. But if you didn't, why do you haunt?
Because I have plans for my house, which don't include a pack of strangers barging in and making themselves at home.
Then you were trying to frighten me away.
You call that trying? I'd barely started. Now, that was enough for all the others. They didn't want any part of it, let me tell you. Didn't even stop to weigh anchor. They just cut their cables and ran.
I think it's very mean of you frightening people. Childish, too.
Well, in your case, I'm prepared to admit I charted the course with regret. You're not a bad-looking woman, you know. Especially when you're asleep.
So? You were in my room this afternoon.
My room, madam.
I thought I'd dreamed it. Did you open the window to frighten me?
I opened the window because I didn't want another accident with the blasted gas. Women are such fools.
You, of all people, should not have brought that up.
I wouldn't call that remark in the best of taste.
But I'm sure it was very kind of you, but I'm quite capable of taking care of myself. Now, if you don't mind.
Turning her back on the ghost, she goes to the range and sets down her candle. She moves the kettle onto a ring and lights the gas beneath it. Suddenly she pauses, picks up the cat, turns back to the ghost.
Well, what's the matter now?
I just wanted to see if you were really there.
Of course I'm really here. And I'll still be here when you've packed up and gone.
She puts the candle down.
But I'm not going. The house suits me perfectly.
My dear woman, it's not your house.
It is, as long as I pay rent.
Pay rent to my blasted cousin.
He's the legal owner.
Legal owner be hanged. It's my house. I want it turned into a home for retired seamen.
Then you should have said so in your will.
I didn't leave a will.
Why not?
Because I didn't expect to kick the blasted gas on with my blasted foot.
I won't be shouted at. Everyone shouts at me and orders me about, and I'm sick of it. Do you hear? Blast! Blast! Blast!
Jumper.
Or laughed at either. I won't leave this house. You can't make me leave it. I won't.
Here, belay that. Stop it now, do you hear me? One thing I can't stand is a woman crying. Stop it, blasted old madam.
I love this house. I thought I must stay here the moment I saw it. I can't explain it. It was as if the house itself were welcoming me and asking me to rescue it from being so empty. You can't understand that, can you? I suppose you think I'm just a silly woman. That's the way I feel.
Well, might be some truth in it of that. I felt that way about a ship once. The First Command. Found her rusting in the Mersey. Gear all foul and a pigsty below. Always swore she sailed twice as sweetly for me as she would for any other master. Out of gratitude. Well, you love the house. That counts for you. And you got spunk. You didn't frighten like the others. That counts for you, too. You may stay. On trial.
Oh, thank you.
Keep your distance, madam.
I'm sorry. You made me so happy.
No intention of making you happy. I merely want to do what's best for the house.
Then we're agreed. And you'll go right away and leave us alone.
I will not go right away. Why should I?
Because of Anna, my little girl. I don't want her frightened into fits.
I never frighten little girls into fits.
But think of the bad language she'd learn and the morals.
Confound it, madam. My language is most controlled. And as for my morals, I lived a man's life and I'm not ashamed of it. But I can assure you no woman's ever been the worse for knowing me. And I'd like to know how many mealy-mouthed blue noses can say the same.
She's much too young to see ghosts.
Very well. I'll make a bargain with you. Leave my bedroom as it is, and I promise not to go into any other room in the house. And you're a brat, you'd never know anything about me.
But if you keep the best bedroom, where should I sleep?
In the best bedroom.
Her eyes widen.
But...
in heaven's name, madam, why not? I bless my soul, I'm a spirit. I have no body, I haven't had one for 4 years. Is that clear?
But I can see you.
All you see is an illusion. It's like a blasted lantern slide.
Well, it's not very convincing. I suppose it's all right.
Then it's settled. I'm probably making a mistake. I always was a fool for a helpless woman.
I'm not helpless.
And if you're so confoundedly competent, you'll notice your kettle's about to boil over.
She hurries to the range and lifts it off.
Oh, one thing more. I want my painting hung in the bedroom. The one that's in the living room.
Must I? It's a very poor painting.
It's my painting. I didn't invite your criticism. I make that part of the bargain. I want you to put it there now, tonight. Good night.
She turns away, then back.
I mean, it doesn't do you just...
He's gone. Lightning flashes. Lucy carries the kettle to the table. She takes the lid off her stone hot water bottle, puts a funnel in the top, and pours in the boiling water.
You might at least have turned the light back on before you left.
The lights come on. Lucy looks round in amazement. She carries her hot water bottle into her bedroom and puts it on the bed. She steps back out onto the landing, then returns, lugging in the large portrait. The captain in the picture has a wry smile and a twinkle in his eye. Lucy sets the portrait down and looks around. Above the sofa is a picture of a sailing ship. Lucy picks up the portrait and rests it on the sofa, leaning it against the wall. It partly hides. She steps back to look at the portrait, hands on hips. Unbuttoning her collar, she walks back towards the bed.
Such nonsense.
She stands in front of the mirror to unfasten her dress. The captain's face is reflected in the glass. Lucy turns, purses her lips, and glares at the picture. She modestly rebuttons her dress as she heads back to the sofa. She tugs the blanket from underneath the painting, unfolds it, and drapes it over the captain's impudent gaze. She looks at her handiwork, furrows her brow, then smiles to herself and starts to undress. Later, she stands before the dressing table mirror in her nightgown. She finishes plaiting her long dark hair and reaches up to turn off the light. She walks to the bed, picks up the hot water bottle and places it under the covers. She takes her pillow and plumps it up. She blows out the bedside lamp. Climbing into bed, she snuggles under the eiderdown and closes her eyes.
Dear, never let anyone tell you to be ashamed of your...
She sits up in fright, holding the covers under her chin. In the bedroom, Martha puts her black dress in a trunk.
There. That's the last of them. Never help with mourning myself. I always say, life's black enough as it is without dressing in it too.
Cheer up, Martha. Life isn't as bad as that.
Who said it was?
Martha goes. Lucy turns to see the captain.
Good afternoon.
What have you done with me monkey puzzle tree?
I expected to chop the firewood by now.
Hang it all, madam. I pounded that tree with my own two hands.
Why?
Because I wanted a monkey puzzle tree in my garden.
Think how much prettier a bed of roses would look there.
I hate roses. I hope the whole blasted bed dies of blight.
I wish you wouldn't swear. It's so ugly.
If you think that's ugly, it's a good thing you can't read my thoughts.
She walks up to him.
You seem to be very earthly for a spirit.
And you, madam, are enough to make a saint take to blasphemy. Blasted women. Always make trouble when you allow one aboard.
Captain Gregg, if you insist on haunting me, you might at least be more agreeable about it.
Why should I be agreeable?
Well, as long as we're living... I mean, if we're to be thrown together so much, life's too short to be forever barking at each other.
Your life may be short, madam. I have an unlimited time at my disposal.
There you go, arguing again. Try to say something pleasant for a change.
He mooches past her, glancing at her hand.
Ah, sir. It's a pretty rig you have on.
Oh, thank you, sir.
Much better than smothering yourself in all that ugly black crepe.
I happen to have been wearing mourning for my husband.
Whom you didn't
He turns to the telescope. Lucy puts her hands on her hips and marches up to him.
How dare you say that?
Because it's true. You were fond of him, perhaps, but you didn't love him.
I suppose you're jealous because no one put on mourning for you.
That shows how little you know about it.
Some poor misguided female, no doubt.
Three poor misguided females, to be exact.
I should think you'd be ashamed of it instead of boasting about it.
Why? They misguided themselves. I never raised a finger to help them.
That's not what I've heard about sailors.
Seamen, confound it. Sailor's a landlubber's word. Why did you marry him?
Edwin?
The captain nods.
I don't really know.
Lucy considers.
He was an architect. He came down to plan an addition to my father's library. I was only 17. I remember I'd just finished a novel in which the heroine was kissed in the rose garden and lived happily ever after. So when Edwin kissed me in the orchard...
But it was different after you left.
She drops her gaze.
He didn't beat you, did he?
Oh, no. Poor Edwin. He never did anything. I'm afraid he wasn't even a very good architect. He couldn't have designed a house like this. Who did?
The captain smiles smugly.
It reminds me of something. An old song or a poem.
Magic casements opening on the foam of perilous seas and fairylands forlorn.
That's Keats, isn't it?
The Nightingale.
Strange to find a sea captain quoting Keats.
Oh, life's slow at sea. Plenty of time for reading in the off watches.
How romantic. Reading lyric poetry up in the crow's nest. With the sheets bellying in the wind.
Sails, blast it all, madam. A sheet's a line, a rope. Ropes can't belly.
I don't know anything about the sea. Except that it is romantic.
That's what all landsmen think. Seamen know better.
Then why did they go to sea?
Because they haven't the sense to stay ashore. Heaven help the ordinary seamen.
Were you ever one?
For several years while I learnt my trade.
It's hard to imagine you being an ordinary anything.
He looks at her with a fond smile, then turns to the window. There's a motor carriage parked by the gate. Two black-clad women alight from it. She joins him at the window.
Oh, dear, whatever can they want?
Who is it?
My blasted in-laws.
She opens the bedroom door and listens.
But she's resting, Mum. Then we'll go up.
Quick, hide or go away or decompose.
Dematerialize, madam.
Whatever it is, do it quickly.
No fear. They can't see me or hear me. Unless I choose that they should.
Oh, then please don't choose. I'll get rid of them.
Why don't you let me? I've had plenty of practice.
No.
Say the word and I'll keelhaul them.
No, you're not to do anything.
Well, Lucy, talking to herself. Oh, my poor Lucy.
The older woman embraces her.
You look so pale.
Well, what an ugly room.
Oh, it is.
Whatever do you want with that telescope?
I like to look at the stars.
You never like to look at the stars when you live with us. Sit down, Mother.
Eva stares at the portrait.
And what a hideous painting.
Anyone with a face like yours, madam, should steer clear of expressing such opinions.
Why on earth don't you take it down?
Because I like it, Eva. I'm very fond of it. Really, I am.
Liar.
Of course. If you want a portrait of a strange man in your room, well, that's up to you. I'm sure you didn't come here merely to criticize the decoration.
No, we did not. Oh, poor Lucy, we've such bad news for you. I suppose it's all for the best, everything considered, don't you, Eva?
And in my opinion, we're just in time.
So perhaps our bad news is good news after all, and now we can all go home and live together and forget all this nonsense about living alone.
What news is this?
Your gold mine, Lucy, it's petered out.
They've stopped paying dividends. It was in the Times this morning.
Lucy's face falls. She sinks onto the sofa beside the captain.
Fast now. Don't make a scene in front of these swabs.
I don't intend to make a scene.
Oh, of course you don't. You're my brave little girl. That's what you are. Oh, Lucy.
Please.
Make her stop that eternal caterwauling or I will take a hand.
You keep out of this.
Oh, Lucy.
Blast.
Oh, did you hear her, Eva?
Yes, I heard her. Stop sniffling, Mother. If that's what you want, we will keep out of
this. I didn't mean you.
Then just whom did you mean?
Well, I could explain, I suppose, but you wouldn't believe me.
All I know is that you're acting in a most peculiar fashion. The only charitable explanation is that the solitude has preyed on your mind.
She thinks you got bats in your belfry.
Oh, pipe down. I mean, I want to think.
Very well, I will pipe down, as you put it. But it should be perfectly obvious that with your income gone, there's only one course for you to follow. And that is to come home, now, with us.
You mean, give up this house?
Naturally. It was idiotic to take it in the first place. And now that you're a pauper, how can you possibly stay?
Lucy stares at the floor. The captain sidles up behind her.
Don't do it, Lucy.
You want me to stay?
Yes.
Do you really mean it?
Of course I mean it. Tell them to shove off. We'll think of something.
She smiles at the women.
I'm sorry. It's very kind of you to want me back, but I'm going to stay. I'll manage somehow. So please be good enough to shove off.
Oh, very well. You're obviously insane, and I, for one, want nothing more to do with you.
Eva marches to the door. Her mother totters after her, handkerchief pressed to her mouth. Eva shuts the door. Lucy turns to the captain. He's gone.
Greg.
The room is empty. Lucy puts her hands on her hips. The captain's waiting for the women on the half landing.
It's too ridiculous.
I'm going to give her one.
Eva turns. The captain stops her.
Stop pulling me, Mother.
I'm not pulling you.
She tries again.
Stop it, I say.
I'm not touching you.
The captain bundles both women downstairs. He marches them through the hall and out the door. Anna watches as Ronnie the dog scampers after them. Mr. Coombs' little car rattles up the bumpy track. Anna's watching him through the telescope as Martha dusts the bedroom.
Mummy's coming aboard in another car.
Mr. Coombs is advising.
He gets out of the car.
Oh, I'm so glad you found the house suitable after all. I'm convinced now that we were unduly concerned about the possibility of a ghost haunting it. As you say, how could such things exist in the 20th century?
Indeed. How could they?
Still, you must admit, it's a very isolated location. And I've often thought of you out here alone, without the protection of a man, the right man, could offer you.
Hearing a noise, Mr. Coombe looks in dismay to see his car rolling back down the hill. Lucy frowns as Mr. Coombe races after it. Vaulting the fence, he catches up with it and clambers aboard. Lucy purses her lips. Angrily, she stalks towards the house and hurries up the steps to the front door. The captain's standing in the living room, warming his hands before the fire. Ronnie the dog is sitting on the chair beside him. Lucy marches in.
I only hope when I reach the afterlife, I have a little more dignity.
Dignity? Do you call it dignified to throw yourself at a herring-gutted swab like that?
I asked Mr. Coombe here because he's the logical man to help me find lodgers for the summer.
Lodgers?
He dismisses the dog.
Yeah, weigh your anchor. Forgive me, my dear, I've been seriously misled. I thought you wanted to sign him on for a husband.
Mr. Coombe? That walrus?
It's my experience that women will do anything for money.
And now you and your blasted experiences have ruined everything.
No, there's no harm done. Couldn't allow you to take in lodgers in any case. They're worse than passengers at sea.
It's them or starve.
Not at all, my dear. I've solved all your problems. You're going to write a...
She stares at him, amazed.
A book? But I couldn't. I find it hard enough to write a postcard.
No, but I can. I can write a book, and you can put it down on paper for me.
But what will the book be about?
Me. The story of my life. And we'll call it, Blood and Swash. Yes, Blood and Swash by Captain X.
I don't think that's at all a nice title.
It's not meant to be. It's meant to be sensational, like the subject.
But it takes months to write a book. What are we to live on in the meantime?
You have jewelry?
A little.
Pawn it.
But I couldn't.
Blast your eyes, madam, will you understand? You're trying to claw off a lee shore. Can't afford to be squeamish.
I do understand, and don't swear at me.
Stop with that ugly brooch.
But Edwin's mother gave it to me.
All the more reason to pawn it. You don't like Edwin's mother, and you hate her brooch.
Really, Captain Gregg, I'll have you know I'm very fond of my mother-in-law.
Very well. If you're so fond of her, you can go back.
Lucy looks down. She fingers the brooch at her collar, then sinks into a chair and unpins it.
I think I can get about £10 for it.
Ah, I'm glad they're going to be sensible. And since we're to be collaborators, you can call me Daniel.
That's very good of you.
And I shall call you Lucia.
My name is Lucy.
Doesn't do you justice, my dear. Women named Lucy are always being imposed upon, but Lucia, there's a name for an Amazon, for a queen.
I don't feel much like a queen. I feel frightened and confused and wondering what the future will bring.
Don't you trust me?
Oh, I do, Daniel, when I'm talking to you. But when you're not here, Well, it's asking a great deal to expect anyone to trust her whole future to a... to someone who isn't real.
But I am real. I'm here because you believe I'm here.
She studies him.
And keep on believing. And I'll always be real to you.
Yes, Daniel.
Evening. Lucy sits at a desk in her bedroom typing. Daniel stands by her. He reads a page, then puts it down. He peers at another. He strolls to the window and stands smoking his pipe as Lucy works on. Daniel paces, then stops and looks round at her. Lucy rests her cheek on her hand, scanning the page in the typewriter.
You haven't finished a sentence.
I know, it's that word. I've never written such a word.
Well, it's a perfectly good word.
I think it's a horrid word.
It means what it says, doesn't it?
All too clearly.
Now, what word do you use if you wanted to convey that meaning?
I don't use any.
Well, hang it all, Lucia, if you're going to be prudish, we'll never get the book written. Put it down the way I give it to you.
Reluctantly, Lucy stabs at the keys.
Good. Now, at this point, having had a drink, I went upstairs.
Why?
Why what?
Why? Did you go upstairs?
Because I saw no harm in it.
You must have been very young and foolish.
I was young, but I was never foolish. Inexperienced, perhaps. Curious, as young men are. Eager for adventure. I matured early.
I wish I'd known you then. How old were you, Daniel?
16. It was my first voyage.
Only 16. I suppose you'd run away from home.
Yes, I was an orphan. Brought up by a maiden aunt in a country village. Now, let's get on with it. Where was I?
Upstairs.
Ah, yes. The customs of Marseille are different to any...
Different from?
To or from, who cares? This isn't a blasted literary epic. It's the unvarnished story of a seaman's life.
It certainly is unvarnished.
Well, smear on your own varnish. Change the grammar all you please, but leave the guts in it.
Lucy glances at him sharply and stands.
I think it would be nice if we included a chapter about your early life. Your school days.
I never went to school. I was educated by the vicar.
Poor man, he must have had a dreadful time.
He enjoyed every minute of it. Except the time I put a snake in his bed.
You must have been a horrid little boy.
I suppose you were a model of all the virtues when you were 12.
Certainly I was. I won a prize for deportment at school.
I can see you. Fat little girl in hair ribbons.
I wasn't fat. I was skinny.
Just as bad.
And I wore my hair in braids.
They stand face to face.
You still have freckles.
Only 7 of them. And I'm told they're most...
He gazes at her.
They are at that.
Good heavens, 11 o'clock. I had no idea it was so late.
Yes, you'd better be getting some sleep. We'll put in a full day tomorrow.
He walks to the window.
Daniel, what did your aunt do when you ran away to sea?
Oh, probably thanked heaven there was no one around to fill our house with mongrel puppies and track mud in our carpets.
Did she write to you?
Every Sunday for 7 years. I was at sea when she died. It was the year I got my mate's ticket.
Lucy folds her arms. Her eyes take on a dreamy expression. The captain studies her.
What are you thinking about, Lucia?
I'm thinking how lonely she must have felt. Without clean carpet.
She gazes into space. The room is suddenly empty, the captain gone, the curtains billow by the open window. Lucy comes to and notices he's vanished. She walks to the desk and blows out the lamp. Morning. Martha bicycles along the track outside the house. Her full skirts and petticoats ripple in the breeze. She parks her bike by the fence and takes vegetables and a loaf of bread from the basket. She walks up the garden path towards the house. Lucy is sitting on a bench outside. Martha sees her and bustles over.
Seen that coombe in the village? He gave me this for you.
Oh, thanks, Martha.
It's another demand for payment of the rent.
He did say something about sending the bailiffs to put us out. I got a little money put by, Mum. There ain't been nothing to spend it on here.
Oh, thank you, Martha. But I wouldn't dream of taking it. We'll manage somehow.
Yes.
Martha heads indoors. The captain stands on the terrace watching. When Martha's gone, he strolls up to Lucy.
It's unimportant. Don't worry about it.
What if he sends the bailiffs?
I'll handle them. Bailiffs, nothing but sea lawyers come ashore.
I'm so tired, Daniel. I can't see straight or think straight.
Ah, now then. There's only one more chapter to do. Better be at it.
He bends over her. Lucy stares at the ground.
Lucia.
I'm ready, Daniel.
Good, my dear.
They smile at each other. In the bedroom that evening, the captain dictates.
To all who follow the hard and honorable profession of the sea, to the afterguard and forecastle alike, to masters, mates and engineers, to able-bodied and ordinary seamen, to stokers, apprentices, ship's boys, carpenters, sailmakers and sea cooks, I dedicate this volume. The end.
The end.
Now, tomorrow you take it to the publishers.
I hope they like it. They must like it.
They will.
Strange. I didn't think so at first. But somehow it's a very wise book.
It has elements of wisdom in it, my dear. I didn't lead a very wise life myself, but it was a full one. And a grown-up.
He points to the window.
You come of age very quickly through shipwreck and disaster.
I never understood the sea before, or the men who go to sea. Why did you write the book, Daniel? It wasn't merely to save the house for me.
Partly that. For you and the retired seaman you'll leave it to in your will. But mostly to help people understand. To make them understand. All those comfortable swabs who sit at home on their beam ends, reveling in the luxuries that seamen risk their lives to bring to them. And despising the poor devils who they so much as touch a drop of rum and even sneering at people who try to do them some good. Like you and me.
She gazes at him, her eyes bright with admiration. He turns away.
Tomorrow, the publishers. Tackett and Sproul in Great Smith Street. I'll be sure you see Sproul. He owned a small sailing yacht. Came in fourth in a club regatta once and fancied himself as the very devil of a seafaring man. Tell you the truth, he doesn't know a crojack from a scuttlebutt.
Lucy opens the French window and walks out onto the balcony. Mist rolls in from the sea. Lucy gazes out over the rail as the captain joins her.
Ship out there. Too close by the sound.
It's the loneliest sound. Like a child lost and crying in the dark.
He's lost, all right. With the captain cursing a blue streak and wondering why he ever went to sea instead of opening a grocer's shop like a sensible man. Fog in the channel's treacherous. Trying to face a nor'easter.
Still, it's honest, the sea. It makes you face things honestly, doesn't it?
Something on your mind?
Yes. What's to become of us, Daniel? Of you and me?
Nothing can become of me. Everything's happened. It can happen.
But not to me. When we were writing the book, I was happy. We were accomplishing something together. Now, when I try to think about the future, it's all dark and confused. Like trying to see into the fog.
You've been working too hard. Cooped up in the house too long. You need a change of scene.
But I love it here.
You'll be out in the world more. Meeting people. Seeing men.
I have no desire to see men.
You should, Lucia. You're a confoundedly attractive woman. Oh, hadn't you noticed? Really, my dear, you owe it to yourself.
She heads past him towards the door.
Good night.
She walks back into the bedroom.
My dear.
Sadly, Lucy wanders to the desk. She looks down at the manuscript. She turns to look at the clock on the mantelpiece, then sinks down into the chair beside the fire.
Oh, Daniel. I'm afraid we've got ourselves into an awful fix.
Lucy walks briskly down a busy street, passing a pearly king on the pavement. She approaches the office of Tackett and Sproul and heads inside. A dapper-looking gentleman is coming down the stairs. He turns to gaze admiringly at Lucy as they pass, then heads upstairs after her. Lucy walks into the first floor office. She shuts the door behind her and walks up to the clerk. The gentleman comes in, reaches the desk first, and leans across it.
I should like to see Mr. Sproul, please.
I see you're back, Mr. Filer.
Obviously.
Have you decided to wait?
Forever, if I must.
I should like to see Mr. Sproul, please.
Can't see Mr. Sproul without an appointment.
But I have a manuscript.
So you have a manuscript. Most unusual.
No more so than your adenoids and your bad manners. Now take the lady's name.
Leave your name.
Mrs. Edwin Muir.
Mrs.
Mrs. Edwin Muir. Gull Cottage, Whitecliff, by the sea. Can't I have just a few moments with Mr. Sproul now? I've come all the way in from Whitecliff.
Offer, Mel.
The clerk goes. Lucy turns her back on the gentleman and walks over to a glass-fronted bookcase. The man follows her.
Is it a cookbook? I hope not another life of Byron. Or is it a book of dreams? You're trying to give me a hint. Has it something to do with ice?
She gives him a chilly stare.
Is it really very important for you to see old Sproul?
Oh, yes, so important.
Then see him you shall. It is your good fortune that I'm not only irresponsible, but also unreasonable.
I don't understand.
I had an appointment at 11 o'clock. I arrived at 10:30 and wouldn't wait. I'm only here now because I followed you back. So you may have my appointment, for which you are just in time.
That's very good of you, but I'm afraid I can't.
Now, my dear young woman, if you will set aside your book of social graces for just long enough to seize an opportunity that you want very much, by merely indulging a small, natural, selfish instinct.
Without doubt, sir, you are the most forward gentleman I have ever encountered.
Without doubt.
Mr. Farley.
Forward.
Oh, no, no, I couldn't.
It's quite all right.
Oh, no, really.
He ushers her through a door marked private.
Here now.
She's mad about you. Couldn't you tell?
Come in, Farley, come in. Your new book is terrible. The most awful trash I've had in my desk since... Who are you?
I'm... That is...
Who let you in?
Why, the gentleman outside said it was all right.
Oh, he did he? Well, it isn't all right. And I'll trouble you to take yourself elsewhere.
Oh, please, Mr. Sproul. I simply had to get in to see you. I have a manuscript.
Of course you have. 20 million discontented females in the British Isles, and every blessed one of them's writing a novel.
But
now, don't tell me what's in it, I know. Bless my soul, madam, I've got to publish this bilge in order to stay in business, but I don't have to read it. No, madam, I do not. And now, if you'll pardon me, I'm busy.
Come back here, you blasted grandpa.
The publisher, who'd reached the door, turns and stares at Lucy.
Madam, you're such a nice-looking woman, too.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry, Mr. Sproul. I didn't mean to say that. But you're all wrong about the book. It isn't what you think at all. It's a biography. It's the unvarnished record of a sailor's life.
A sailor's life?
He takes the manuscript.
I ask your pardon, madam, but what do you know about sailors?
Oh, a great deal, believe me.
Mm. Unvarnished, you say?
She nods.
Well, perhaps I have time for a few pages.
He puts the package on his desk and opens it. Lucy sits nervously beside the desk as the old whiskery publisher licks his thumb and moves aside the covering page.
What's your name?
Mrs. Muir.
As he settles down to read, his eyebrows inch up. He looks askance at Lucy and reads another page. A lady waits at the clerk's desk.
I have been waiting here for 3 hours. I consider it outrageous.
She marches to the door, passing Mr. Fairley on his way in. Mr. Fairley steps up to the clerk.
Still in there?
Send lunch and then at 2.
4-2?
The clerk nods. Mr. Fairley sighs. In Sproul's office, the publisher is reading the last page. He puts it down and beams.
Well, you're not going to pretend that you wrote this.
No.
No, it's a man's book. And what a man. Is he your husband, Mrs. Muir?
Oh, no.
She stares at her lap.
This Captain X. I'd like very much to meet him.
Oh, I'm afraid that's impossible. He's away.
On a voyage, of course.
Yes. A very long voyage.
Bless my soul. What a yarn. What a life. I'll tell you a secret. If I hadn't had a mother and 2 sisters to support, I'd have gone to sea myself. Bless my soul, to live like that, instead of sitting there turning out indigestible reading matter for a bilious public. Of course we'll publish it, Mrs. Muir. Now you're empowered by the captain to act for him?
Yes, he's given me the rights.
Good. Well, my dear, you've presented me with the most enjoyable day. Bless my soul, yes, remarkable. Now, you just leave everything to me. And be happy that you know such a man. There aren't many like him these days. You appreciate that?
Yes, I think so.
He opens the door for her.
Goodbye, Mr. Sproul.
Goodbye, Mrs. Muir.
Goodbye.
In the outer office, Lucy draws herself up and sweeps out past Mr. Fairley.
Mr. Farley.
Coming.
Mr. Fairley follows her. Outside, it's raining. As Lucy stands disconcerted in the porch, Mr. Fairley comes up behind her.
It's easy to understand why the most beautiful poems about England in the spring were written by poets living in Italy at the time.
How do you do?
I'm not a poet, but I've got an umbrella, and your hat, if I may say so, is singularly inadequate under the circumstances.
I didn't bargain for this blasted rain. That is, I'm afraid I shall be late and miss the last train for home.
I could call you.
She starts to smile.
If you ask.
Then glowers. She steps into the rain. He pulls her back.
Oi, cab!
Putting up his umbrella, he darts to the curb and beckons a hackney carriage. Returning to the porch, he escorts Lucy across the pavement to the cab.
Where to?
Victoria.
Victoria, what a coincidence. Victoria, cabby.
He gets in beside her and the cab moves off.
I know you won't mind sharing my cab with me, will you?
Not at all.
She sits stiff and tight-lipped. He leans close.
The word you're looking for is brass.
Brass?
To describe my behaviour and me, you don't approve of either, do you?
Not very much. Still, in a way, I should be grateful to you.
Of course. Why?
As Mr. Sproul has agreed to publish my book.
Splendid. So the old boy's developed a weakness for feminine literature, has he? I can't say that it's one of mine.
This book might surprise you.
It's surprising enough to find a lady author. Infinitely more exciting than her heroine could possibly be.
Do you write, Mr.?
My name is Miles Fairley. Yes, I write a little. Children's books.
Children's books? You? I should like to see one.
I'm afraid you already have. I write under the name of Uncle Neddy.
Uncle Neddy? You're Uncle Neddy?
Ridiculous, isn't it?
Then all of your cynicism must be nothing but a pose. You're adored by half the children in the world.
Uncle Neddy is a pose. Deep in my innermost heart, I loathe the little monsters.
My little daughter is not a monster. And she'll be very excited to know I've been talking to her favorite author.
I shall make an exception of your daughter. I'm looking forward to meeting her. And your husband, too.
My husband is dead.
Oh. Oh?
She looks straight ahead.
Oh, I do wish he'd hurry.
Well, there's no rush now. We'll get there in time.
At Victoria, he ushers her to a carriage. Lucy steps in. Miles stays on the platform and shuts the door.
Well, goodbye, Mrs. Muir.
Goodbye, Mr. Bill. And thank you very much.
Not at all. Are you all right?
Oh, yes. Quite all right.
She dabs at her eyes with a hanky. As the train draws away, he snatches a hanky from her and presses it to his lips. Lucy allows herself a smile. Miles Fairley stands on the platform, breathing in the scent from the dainty white handkerchief. In the carriage, Lucy closes the window, smiles and sits thoughtfully. Rain courses down the glass. With sudden determination, Lucy opens her bag, takes out a small mirror and adjusts her hair. She puts the mirror back. The train passes through a tunnel. The captain materializes beside her.
Cheer-o.
Oh. You've been eavesdropping.
Feminine literature. What does he mean, feminine literature?
He had no way of knowing it's your book.
Brass, he says. I'll polish his brass for him. And the way he was smirking at you like a cat at the fishmongers. You should have slapped his face.
Why? I found him rather charming.
Rather charming. Now you're starting to talk like him.
How in blazes do you want me to talk?
That's better.
I think you're being extremely childish.
I'm only trying to protect you from your own worst instincts.
I'll manage my own instincts, thank you.
What made you lie to the blighter?
I didn't lie to him.
You did? You told him he was Anna's favorite author. You know perfectly well she hates Uncle Neddy. And reads nothing but Dead-Eyed Dick, the Rover of the Spanish Main.
I had to say something.
He moves to the opposite seat.
In another minute, I would have.
Why, Daniel, I believe you're jealous.
Of course I'm not jealous. You take me for a blasted schoolboy. Besides, jealousy is a disease of the flesh.
I've never known you to be so disagreeable. Today of all days.
What's so wonderful about today?
The book, Daniel. Mr. Sproul liked the book.
course he liked it.
And now I can buy the house.
She takes a seat beside him.
Just as we planned.
Not sure I want you to have a blasted house after all.
Oh, Daniel, please.
Oh, I suppose being a woman, you can't help it.
Can't help what?
Making a fool of yourself.
Daniel, you stop sulking. You yourself said that I should mix with people, that I should see men.
I said men, not perfumed parlor snakes.
He's a man and a very nice one. Anyway, I shall never see him again.
An old man opens the door.
Cheer off, you blasted mud turtle. There's no room.
I beg your pardon.
The whiskered old gentleman stalks off. Lucy looks at the captain and grins. Slowly his sulk turns to a smile. It's a sunny morning at Whitecliff. Bathing machines stand by the water's edge. Families are playing on the sand. An old man chisels Anna's name into a post on the breakwater.
Will my name stay there forever, Mr. Scroggins?
Mm-hmm. Forever and a day. And I've cut it nice and deep so all the ships at sea can see it as they sail along.
My goodness!
She dashes off and runs up the ramp into one of the bathing machines. She opens the door at the end and calls out across the water. Lucy's wading out in her bathing costume.
Mummy, come and see what Mr. Scroggins has done.
I'll be right on, darling.
Using a rope, Lucy reels herself in. She climbs up the steps into the little hut on wheels. She grabs a toweling cloak and puts it round her shoulders. Fastening it at the neck, she comes down the ramp leading from the opposite end of the bathing machine down onto the beach. Smiling happily, Lucy walks up to Mr. Scroggins. Anna races ahead.
Mr. Scroggins says I'll always be here. All the captains of all the ships will look at me through spyglasses.
That's very thoughtful of Mrs. Roberts. Just think of all the lovely shipwrecks we'll have on this beach. Now, in the meantime, what do you say to getting dressed and plotting our course for home?
Oh, please, Mommy. Mrs. Roberts and I have got to build a breakwater in the canal.
I'll be pleased to bring her home, Mum.
All right, Skipper. But mind you're not too late.
Lucy takes off her bathing bonnet and unpins her hair. Later, fully dressed, she climbs up the steps from the beach. The path zigzags up through pine woods. Passing a bush, Lucy notices a white hanky tied to it. She stops and he looks around. Smiling, she moves on, taking the handkerchief with her. Reaching a grassy clearing, she sees a man sitting in front of an easel painting. It smiles fairly. Clutching the handkerchief, Lucy approaches. Miles sees her and puts down his palette.
A life is just one coincidence after another, isn't it?
Thank you for returning my handkerchief, Mr.
I feel rather ashamed about having taken it.
You should be.
Only as a writer, of course. It's much too obvious a device.
And in questionable taste.
It's very necessary.
I don't see.
I wanted to have something of you until I saw you again.
Lucy lowers her gaze bashfully, then walks towards the easel.
You're quite accomplished, aren't you? I should think being Uncle Neddy would satisfy anyone.
No, I also paint. Under the name of Renoir.
Oh, you're such a fool.
It's the nicest thing you've ever said to me.
And what, if anything, do you do as Miles Fairley?
Play the fool, generally. Specifically, I behave quite idiotically towards a certain young lady that I fell in love with while passing on a stair.
Mr. Fairley, please.
I have no illusions about my conduct. Am I being unforgivably offensive, Lucy?
Lucy?
That's your name.
It's been so long since anyone called me that. No, you've done nothing really unforgivable. It's just that I'm not... That no one is...
Come and take a look at my canvas.
He lifts up a cloth cover.
Why, it's me. You've been painting me. You've been watching me bathe.
But always from a respectful distance.
She sits in front of it. He leans down beside her.
Not too bad, is it?
I think it's very flattering, really.
You'll need a thousand.
He stoops to kiss her. Their lips meet. Lucy draws back and stands up.
That was unforgivable, wasn't it? But I shall not go away, even if you send me. And I shall see you again, even if you forbid it.
I'm sure I have no control over where you go or what you do.
Then you won't forbid it.
She looks up at him uncertainly, lowers her gaze, then turns and marches away up the path. Miles stanch as her go, a smile playing on his lips. Later, Lucy walks along a dusty track. She slows and stops. The captain is sitting against a tree trunk, eyeing her.
So now you've been kissed in the orchard all over again.
You've been spying on me.
I merely happened to be cruising in the vicinity.
I don't believe
it. Why did you let him?
I didn't. He took me unaware.
Well, dear, since Eve picked the apple, no woman's ever been taken entirely unawares.
Just what do you mean to insinuate by that?
When a woman's kissed, it's because, deep down, she wants to be kissed.
That is nothing but masculine conceit.
Nevertheless, it's true. Well, now what happens?
He'll stay or he'll go away. It doesn't matter to me one way or the other.
I think it matters to you more than you'll admit. Isn't that so, Lucia?
Why bother to ask me, Daniel? You seem to know my mind better than I do. You don't like him, do you?
He puts brilliantine on his hair.
Most men do.
And he uses perfume. Last year drove me out of his room.
You shouldn't have been in his room in the first place.
So you can find an excuse for everything.
Only because you're attacking him, Daniel.
I know. It's a natural human reaction.
I wish you wouldn't be so superior just because you're not alive.
And he is. Very much so.
It's no crime to be alive.
No, my dear. Sometimes it's a great inconvenience. The living can be hurt.
I don't intend to be hurt.
No captain intends to pile his ship up on a reef, but it happens.
You yourself said I should go about in the world. That means taking risks.
I know, dear. Real happiness is worth almost any risk. But be careful. There may be breakers ahead.
I will have that.
She walks slowly on. The captain stands and watches her go. The painting of Lucy in her bathing costume is framed and hangs on the wall of the bedroom. Martha frowns at Lucy's, then grins at the portrait of the captain beside it. Marshalling her features into a sobered expression, she moves to the chest as Lucy comes in.
Hello, Martha.
Hello.
Like my picture?
No.
That's honest, anyway.
It's indecent, that's what it is. Him painting you in your bathing costume like you was a... I don't know what.
Oh, come, Martha. This is the 20th century. We must rid ourselves of the old fetishes and taboos.
Learnt a lot of new words, ain't you?
We're never too old to learn.
No, nor to make fools of ourselves either, Uncle Nick.
She makes the bed angrily.
All right, my girl. Let's have it.
What's he up to? What's he want with you?
Well, I rather think he's going to ask me to marry him.
And you'd be willing to.
I might. Why shouldn't I?
Because he ain't good enough for you, that's why not. He's the kind of man no decent woman would associate with.
Martha, what right have you to talk like that?
Well, I got a right to my own feelings, and I got a feeling about him.
How dare you?
I'm sorry, but it's just that I've been so worried about you lately.
No, Martha, there's nothing to worry about. I know he isn't perfect.
Perhaps he's conceited and erratic.
Even childish. But he's real.
Real?
I thought I was impervious to emotion. A respectable widow woman with a growing child and a hide like a rhinoceros. But I'm not. I need companionship and laughter and all the things a woman needs. I suppose I need love.
Well... I hope he can give
Lucy
it to
puts
you.
An arm round her.
Now, suppose you go on downstairs and make us both a cup of tea.
Martha walks reluctantly to the door.
I'll finish up.
Yes.
Lucy turns to study her portrait. She smiles at it fondly, then looks at the one of the captain. Tilting her head to one side, she addresses the rugged, handsome face with its twinkling eyes and salty sea dog's beard.
Well, Daniel, haven't you anything to say?
She turns sadly away. That night in the garden, Miles and Lucy are in a passionate embrace.
Happy?
Oh, I've never felt like this before.
How?
I don't know.
Tell me.
Like looking down from high up.
is right.
Lucy looks towards the house. Light from a downstairs window goes out.
Martha's gone up. It's Anne's bedtime.
Just this once, pretend you forgot.
But I didn't.
Just this one night.
There'll be so many nights, darling. Two lifetimes full, till we're both old and even Anne is grown and married.
Miles looks troubled.
What's wrong?
I'm jealous. I'm even jealous of a little girl.
But she's my daughter. I can't just forget my duty to her.
When you're with me, I want you to forget about everyone else in the world. Your duty and what the world will say.
I think you must be a magician. You make it seem all wrong to consider my duty and only right.
He stops her lips with a kiss. The captain is watching behind the branches of a tree. He turns and frowns, sways uneasily, then walks away. Early morning. Lucy's in bed. The captain stands by the window and addresses her sleeping form.
I thought you were one woman with sense. But you're like all the rest of them. Fool for any man who'll promise you the moon and end by taking everything you have to give.
Lucy stirs a little.
Oh, don't trouble yourself, my dear. It's not your fault. I should have known it was on the chart. You've made your choice, the only choice you could make. You've chosen life. And that's as it should be. Whatever the reckoning. And that's why I'm going away, my dear. I can't help you now. I can only confuse you more and destroy whatever chance you have left of happiness. You must make your own life amongst the living. And whether you meet fair winds or foul, find your own way to harbor in the end.
He gazes at her fondly, then leans close, his face inches from hers.
Lucia, listen to me. Listen, my dear. You've been dreaming of a sea captain that haunted this house, of talks you had with him, even a book you both wrote together. But Lucia, you wrote the book, you and no one else. A book you imagined from his house, from his picture on the wall, from his gear lying around.
His beard almost brushes her lips.
It's been a dream.
Lucy sleeps on unaware. The captain slowly stands.
And in the morning, and the years after, you'll only remember it as a dream. And it'll die, as all dreams must die.
Sadly, the captain moves towards the open French window with its view of the sea. Then he turns back to look at Lucy.
How you'd have loved the North Cape, and the fjords and the midnight sun. Sail across the reef at Barbados, where the blue water turns to green. To the Falklands, where a southerly gale whips the whole sea white. What we've missed, Lucia. What we've both missed.
The ghost starts to dematerialize.
My darling.
The captain fades to nothing. The French window closes softly. Lucy. Martha's dusting the bedroom. Lucy, dressed to go out, opens a letter.
Listen to this. From Mr. Sproul. It's about the book I've written. Our check. For £100 advance royalties as you requested.
You mean to tell me they paid you good money for that?
Martha, have you been reading my book?
I'm supposed to dust in here, and what falls under me eye falls under me eye.
I'm surprised at you. It's like eavesdropping.
I'm surprised at you. Such language. Lummy.
Well, if you're writing about a sea captain, you have to use the sort of language he would use.
You'd have a hard time living up to your idea of him.
Mr. Sproul wants me to come into town, sign some papers, but I can't possibly leave here now,
Just when what?
I'm expecting Mr. Fairley. We're having a picnic.
You mean he is?
I heard you, Martha. Please remember that I'm going to marry him.
Yes, Martha picks up her basket of cleaning things.
By the way, I've been thinking we might put that portrait of Captain Gregg up in the attic.
Don't you like it anymore?
It was a silly idea to hang it in here. I don't know what possessed me. Atmosphere, I suppose.
Yes, I'll hang it in my room if you don't mind.
Of course not.
Perhaps you can get Uncle Neddy to paint you one of himself instead.
Martha walks out. Lucy turns from the closed door and sits at her desk. She takes a sheet of writing paper, dips her pen in the inkwell, and starts to write.
Dear Mr. Sproul, I find that I am unable to leave Whitecliff this week and hope that you...
Martha bursts in.
A boy brought a note for you.
Lucy rips open the envelope. Martha tries to read it over Lucy's shoulder.
Billy do, I dare say.
Lucy looks at her sharply and scans the note.
Oh, how terrible. Mr. Fairley has been called up to London for a few days.
What's so terrible about that?
Martha walks out. Lucy looks back at the note thoughtfully. She smiles and rips up her letter to Mr. Sproul. In Sproul's office, she signs the contract.
There. Is that all, Mr. Sproul?
Except to deposit the checks to your account when they come in. I congratulate you, my dear. And I congratulate the captain, too.
Oh, the captain.
And I intend to hold your promise to introduce us.
Oh, yes, I did promise, didn't I? You know, someday when I've known you a little longer, Mr. Sproul, I'll tell you the truth about the captain. Goodbye, and thank you again.
Goodbye, Mr.
Lucy goes through to the outer office. She pauses as she passes the clerk.
Would you please give me Mr. Fairley's address?
Miles Fairley?
Yes, please.
The clerk looks it up in his book.
Here it is, Mrs. Muir. Number 14 Albemarle Street.
Thank you so much.
An open carriage draws up outside a London townhouse. Lucy pays the driver. He tips his bowler hat and Lucy steps out. She climbs the steps to Miles Fairley's front door and rings the bell.
Yes, ma'am? I'd like to see Mr. Fairley, please.
Yes, ma'am.
The maid shows her in.
What name, please?
It's Mrs. Muir.
Yes, ma'am. Will you wait in there, please?
The maid bobs a curtsy and goes. Lucy is into an elegant dress. She walks across a Persian carpet to admire a painting on the wall, a portrait of a good-looking woman. The woman looks not unlike Lucy, with curly dark hair piled in a bun. Lucy crosses the room to examine another painting of the same woman with two young children, a boy and a girl. As she studies the painting, its subject walks in.
Mrs. Muir? The maid said you wanted to see my husband. Perhaps I can help you.
Husband?
Or if you don't mind waiting, he should be back soon. He's taken the children to the park. I've had them abroad for the past few months and we just returned. Miles is making up for lost time.
They sit together on the sofa.
You're a friend of his. You know how fond he is of the children.
Lucy stares in dismay.
You are a friend of his, aren't you?
I'm a writer. Mr. Fairley and I have the same publisher.
But how exciting. I don't often meet one of Miles' literary friends. You'll wait for him, won't you? I expect him back any minute. And we'll have tea.
No, I'll go. I'm afraid I've made a mistake.
A mistake, Mrs. Muir?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Mrs. Fairley lays a hand on Lucy's arm.
I think I understand, my dear. And I'm sorry, too. Truly, I am. You see, it isn't the first time something like this has happened.
Lucy takes a deep breath and turns on her heel. She marches briskly to the hall.
Mrs. Muir.
Lucy lets herself out. Mrs. Fairley raises her hand but lets it drop. Outside, Lucy walks slowly down the steps. Holding herself stiffly, she walks along the pavement. A passerby glances at her, then strolls on. Back home at night, Lucy paces on the balcony outside her bedroom window. Martha comes into the room with a tray. She peers at Lucy through the window. Lucy is standing by the rail, gazing out fretfully. Martha sets down the tray, opens the French window, and comes out onto the balcony.
Come on in, Mum. I brought you some nice hot milk.
Lucy covers her face with her hands. Martha puts her arms about her.
Oh, there. He ain't worth it. Blast his eyes. He ain't worth it.
It's an overcast morning. Lucy walks along the empty beach with her little dog, Ronnie, scampering ahead of her. Lucy slows as she reaches the water. She sees Anna's name clearly carved in one of the posts. Lucy pauses, then moves quickly on. Martha's in the kitchen. She peers out of the window, then opens the back door. Ronnie trots in, followed by Lucy.
Where you been?
Just walking.
You've been doing a lot of walking these last few months. You mustn't go tiring yourself out now.
I'm not a bit tired.
Off to your room and a nice bit of shut-eye before tea.
Lucy goes into the hall. Martha bustles along behind her.
Martha, do you know what day this is?
Wash day.
Yes, but it was exactly a year ago that we came here. We went up these stairs together and then I hurt my finger on the window. Remember?
Yes, ma'am.
Then I had a dream. I remember you telling me about it.
They enter the bedroom.
It was a very strange dream. The first of many dreams. Now then, off with your dress. No, I'll rest in the big chair. Whatever you say, ma'am.
Martha lifts the terrier off a rug on the sofa and puts the rug over her mistress.
Thank you, Martha.
Martha leaves. Lucy snuggles under the rug and shuts her eyes, then opens them as the ship's clock above the mantelpiece starts to chime. It shows the time as 4 o'clock. Lucy is suddenly alert and watchful. Ronnie, on the sofa, pricks up his ears. Lucy peers intently at the French window. She sits up, craning forward in her seat. The window stays resolutely shut. Lucy sinks back into the leather armchair. She glances again at the window, then sadly lowers her gaze. She folds her hands across her lap, shuts her eyes and falls asleep. The captain's picture gazing down at her. A flock of gulls soars up above the waves as rollers crash onto the beach. The sea churns, white spray flies up as huge waves break over the rocks. The sky is black with clouds as the wind whips the sea into a mountain of foam. The sea calms. Lucy strides along the sand on her solitary walk on the beach. The post of the breakwater, carved with Anna's name, leans at an angle eroded by the years. Lucy, now middle-aged, has exchanged her long Edwardian gowns for a practical tweed suit. Her skirt ends just below the knee. A young woman hails her.
Annie! Hello, Anna!
Anna's driven in an open-topped sports car. Her young man draws up outside and embraces her mother.
Anne, oh, darling, this is a surprise. How did you get off from the university?
They don't know I'm away. Come on, Bill, don't be shy. This is Bill, Mummy.
How do you do?
His real name is Sir Evelyn Anthony Peregrine Skade, so of course he's called Bill. And we're thinking of getting engaged.
Anne.
Well, I haven't even asked her yet, but if she keeps on committing us, I suppose I'll have to.
We've come for your blessing, Mummy, and we haven't had tea.
Anna, you quite take my breath away.
The three of them walk into the house. Anna gestures to the living room.
Darling, you just make yourself at home in there, and we'll help Martha with the tea.
Well, if I'm not wanted.
Oh. We'll sing out when we want you. Come on, Mummy.
Anna takes Lucy's arm. They go into the kitchen.
There'll be two more for tea, Martha.
Martha, Miss Anna.
Oh. And you'll find this strange young man in the living room.
Oh. Well, what do you think?
Gracious, you haven't given me time to think. I gather his name is Sir Evelyn Scaife, and you want to marry him.
Sir Evelyn? I met him at a dance in London. He's a sub-lieutenant in the Navy. You know my weakness for sailor men.
Well, it's the first I've heard of it.
Oh, it's a lifelong vice.
Well, what do you want me to say?
Don't matter what you say. She'll have her own way, same as her mother. Don't you go making eyes at him now.
And him a lieutenant. Captains is more in my line.
Martha goes out with a tray.
Oh, I've never been so happy in all my life.
Then I'm happy, too. And I shan't waste time with questions.
I knew you wouldn't. And wait till you hear. I've discussed it with Bill. You're to come and live with us, you and Martha.
Oh, no, darling.
Well, but you must. You've been alone so much of your life.
You're very kind, but it's hard to explain. You can be much more alone with other people than you are by yourself. Even if it's people you love. That sounds all mixed up, doesn't it?
No, not a bit. But if you ever change your mind, get a plate, darling.
Anna goes to the dresser.
And some extra cups. No, I won't change my mind. I love this house, and I've been very happy here. And I shall live here till I die.
With Captain Gray?
Lucy stiffens.
What did you say?
With the ghost of Captain Gray?
Anna, what are you talking about?
Oh, I knew the captain very well. When I was a little girl, the first year we lived here, we used to have the most wonderful talk.
You didn't.
It was all a game I'd made up, of course. Sort of a dream game. But it was very real while it lasted. And he stopped coming suddenly. I suppose I was growing too old and sophisticated for him. But I grieved and grieved. I was hopelessly in love with him. Heavens, you look as if you'd seen a... Don't tell me you saw him, too.
Lucy turns away.
No, not for years. Then you did. Oh, Mummy, you don't suppose he really haunted us?
No, darling, things like that can't happen. It was only a dream.
The same dream for both of us?
But perhaps I set you off by telling you about my dreams. Little girls are very impressionable.
I don't remember your telling me. Oh, tell me now. I'd love to hear about them.
But I can't remember them very well. Just bits and pieces. A phrase here and there, a look. And I think I dreamed most of my book, Blood and Swash. I must have. I never could have thought of it. All these years, I've tried to remember. But I can't.
You know what I think? I think you fell in love with him, too.
I did nothing of the sort.
Oh, I wouldn't blame you if you had. When did you stop seeing him?
After about a year, I dreamed we quarreled. It was about a man.
Uncle Neddy.
Anna, did you know that Miles and
I used to pray you wouldn't marry him.
And you were so right. I saw him about 5 years ago at a dinner party. He was bald and fat, and he drank too much, and then he cried. It seems his wife finally had enough and took the children away. You never can tell, can you? Once I thought I wanted to spend the rest of my life with him.
Perhaps he did exist, the captain. Perhaps he did come back and talk to us. Wouldn't it be wonderful if he had? Then you'd have something, you know what I mean, to look back on with happiness.
No, darling, he never existed. We made him up, you and I. I just wasn't intended to have that kind of happiness, and I haven't missed it. Really, I haven't. Oh, I've been lonely at times, but there have been compensations. You, now Bill, and dear Martha. We sit and chatter like a pair of...
Lucy puts her hand on Anna's shoulder.
And this house. And the sea. And the gulls. And memories. I have those, you know. Even if it was a dream. Now come along and we'll join your young man for some tea.
Lucy ushers Anna into the hall and shuts the door. Sunlight sparkles on the sea, waves lap against the sand, the tide ebbs and flows. The sky grows dark, waves crash and swirl around a broken post. On its weather-worn surface can just be made out the name Anna Muir. It's dark. A figure stands on the balcony of Gull Cottage. It's Lucy, her hair grey and drawn into a neat bun. She gazes out into the foggy night. The door of her bedroom opens. Martha, her hair grey like that of a mistress, brings in a glass on a saucer. Martha lays a hot water bottle on the bed and goes to the French window. She steps out onto the balcony.
You come in here.
Lucy follows her in.
Catch your breath. What are you doing out there?
I don't know.
You know what the doctor said?
Oh, bother the doctor. He's an old woman.
You ain't a young one anymore.
There's a letter from Anna.
What'd she say?
Little Lucy's engaged. Little Lucy.
To the captain of a transatlantic plane.
Anna's very happy about it. Says it must run in the family.
Aeroplanes, not in my family, they don't.
I suppose she means captain.
Lucy eases herself down into a chair.
Here, drink your own milk.
Not now, Martha. I'm too tired. And I have a funny pain in my arm.
No wonder standing out there in the fog. Come on, drink it up.
Stop bossing me, Martha. I don't want any hot milk.
No, no, don't get in a state.
I'm not in a state. I just want to be left alone. Bossing me.
Very well. Bossing, I never intended. I only brought the milk for your own.
Martha lets herself out. Martha heads downstairs. Lucy leans back in the chair by the fire.
I'm tired.
She notices the drink on the table beside her, smiles and lifts her hand to pick up the glass of hot milk. She takes a sip. Still holding the glass, she rests her hand on the arm of her chair. She closes her eyes. The drink slips from her grasp. She sits motionless. A shadow looms over her. The captain gazes down at her fondly.
And now you'll never be tired again. Come, Lucia. Come, my dear.
He holds out his arms. She places her hands in his, and he pulls her suddenly young self towards him. Lucy smiles at him, and they walk towards the door. Gazing back over her shoulder, she sees the body of an old lady lying in the chair. The young Lucy smiles up at her handsome captain. Together, they step out onto the landing, arm in arm, and walk down the stairs. Reaching the bottom of the staircase, they pass Martha in the hall. Young Lucy smiles and turns as Martha heads upstairs. Lucy's smile fades. Martha cannot see her and carries on up unaware. The captain draws Lucy on. As they approach the front door, it swings open. Ahead of them is a pathway leading up towards the sky. The door closes behind them. The end. IGFC audio description by Louise Fryer was read by James O'Hara.